Hello, everybody. My name is Bezena Hinton, and I'd like to welcome you today to A Kindergarten Guide to Modern Monetary Theory. I'd like to introduce to you Frank Ash. Frank has got a consulting practice specialising in risk management and investments. He maintains a part-time associate professorship at Macquarie University Applied Finance Centre. Prior to 2002, Frank worked in Australia and Canada with consultancies, insurance companies, investment management firms, bond dealers, and financial software houses. His 30 years of practical experience have been predominantly in the measurement and management of financial risk and return, with an emphasis on asset liability management and developing risk management and measurement tools for novel situations. His passion is for the clear expression of risk concepts to the non-specialist at all levels in the organisation. Frank's going to be speaking to us today for about half an hour and is happy to take questions on the way through, so put up your hand and we'll interrupt if you feel inclined, and then there'll be plenty of time for questions at the end. And I'd now like to hand over to Frank.
Okay. Thanks. Okay, where does money come from and where does it go to? We'd all like to answer this. First off, please, this is going to be a very, very contentious talk. And I don't want any kangaroos in the audience, right? No jumping to conclusions. I'm going to get to the conclusions eventually. Don't jump there. Particularly, I've talked to a number of people about this, and invariably, people jump to the conclusion, which is often wrong, and start arguing saying the conclusion's wrong. But I don't want to argue you to argue with the conclusion. I want you to say, where in what I'm going through are my assumptions wrong or my logic is wrong? Don't say the conclusions are obviously wrong. If you do that, you'll make the same mistake that I did when I started looking at this. Because how did I get there? Well, first off, the other thing, listen to what I say, not what you imagine I say, right? That's the other major danger. Okay, how did I get here, get to this particular point? A couple of years ago, going through the GFC, I sort of said, well, everybody's talking about huge injections of liquidity into the system. Central bank balance sheets are blowing out. The governments are getting huge amounts of spending. And you read one Nobel-winning economist who says, everything's fine. You read another Nobel-winning economist who says, we're going to hell in a handcart. So, okay. If I was in a large financial institution who had a large amount of fixed income assets, and that fits banks, it fits insurance companies, it fits funds management organisations, who do I believe? What is going on in the money system? And so I started to have a look at that because obviously, I'm not running a huge organisation like that, so I can't go along to my house economist. And frankly, if I went along to my house economist, I wouldn't be comfortable that they would be able to come down on one side of the fence or not. So, all right, I had to look into it myself. That's one of the advantages of having a 40% part-time academic position. I've got a little bit of extra time to do that. Now, what I'm going to be talking about is deep down, nitty-gritty movement of money, right? And there are a lot of institutions that I am going to gloss over. For example, the difference between a central bank and a treasury department in a government. For very good reasons, we have those two separate institutions. But for what I'm going to be talking about, I'm just going to meld them all into a general amorphous government here. Because effectively, when push comes to shove, things like independence of central banks and all the rest of it are at the whim of the government. If the government wants to push the central bank to do something, it can rewrite the law and do it, right? It's going to be extremely difficult to do it, but when push comes to shove, it may. So I think that's reasonable to bring that in. There's all sorts of laws, memorandums of understandings, heads of agreements and that between these various things. There's the bond markets, who are supposed to be, you know, next to God in power of what they can do. They're all very important, but we have to remember that they are conventions. There is nothing hard written in the laws of physics or the laws of chemistry that say these things have to work in the way that we imagine that they have worked in the past. And I stress that word imagine. We don't know how they've worked in the past. We imagine how they've worked in the past. So, first off, a bit of a disclaimer. None of this... There's the disclaimer in Morse code. None of this is my own work. I am just standing on the shoulders of giants, as it were. There is a fair bit of body of work that's underlying this. It is certainly not mainstream at the moment. So none of this is my own. In fact, one of the big exponents of this is a guy up in Newcastle University. That's the one just a couple of hundred kilometres up the coast, Bill Mitchell, who writes an extremely readable blog on modern monetary theory. It's basically a mini lecture every day. First off, modern monetary theory. Scratch the word theory. What we're doing here is not actually building a theory. We're looking at a stock flow consistent analysis of money and credit. Okay? I'm not making lots and lots and lots of assumptions, except the standard stock flow assumptions, in that if I give you a dollar, then I have one less dollar and you have one more dollar. And if you happen to lose that dollar, then that's... You know, I can say you've lost it and the government liability to do something about that dollar is gone. If you take a look at other analyses of money, and I have read through what has been called the best textbook on this, the best book on this is almost unreadable. There's lots of other assumptions that we can make in trying to understand money. There are about 10 standard theories at the moment. Interesting, when I read the conclusion of each of these chapters talking about that, it all came up with the idea that, well, actually this doesn't work in practice. And sometimes the conclusion was it doesn't even work in theory. Money is very, very unusual. It's very strange. But I love this approach because it actually doesn't make many assumptions. Watch how many I'm going to make. Okay, first off, I'm going to talk about credit creation. I'm a bank, and look, I know Mike Barker over here is a great bloke. He wants to build a steel mill. He comes along to me and says, I want to borrow $1 billion to build a steel mill. I'm a bank. What do? How long have I known you? Very, very trustworthy. I'm willing to give you $1 billion. And so I... first off, I need the IOU from you. You can scribble it on that piece of paper if you like. This is what banks do. You give me an IOU for $1 billion. I'll give you an IOU for $1 billion. I'm just waiting for it. What happens at that point is, as a bank, my balance sheet still balances. I have an asset, an IOU from Mike for $1 billion. I have given him a liability for me. I have set up a bank account for him, which has $1 billion in it, and he can draw down that bank account. As soon as we've done that deal, which just requires a shifting of 2 little pieces of paper, my balance sheet balances. Right? Anybody think that banks don't work like that? You go along to you go for a mortgage for a house. You shift 2 little pieces of paper, money appears in your bank account. That's how it works. My books still balance if I do that. Ah. So he's going to spend money. And I'm looking around for somebody else's whose name I know in the audience, and unfortunately when that happens my brain goes completely berserk and I just cannot remember names. But you look like a person who's got a hell of a lot of steel that Mike wants to buy to build the steel. Now, he spends the money. You bank with me. When Mike spends that money, he doesn't get 1 billion of these little tiny things, or actually 500,000, because that's
put 500 billion because that's a $2 coin. What he does is he tells me to transfer $1 billion into your account.
And I just go there and shift the money over. So Mike spending money doesn't actually change what happens with me as long as you bank with me. I just shift the money around. What about if you bank with somebody else? Well, I have a reserve account at the RBA, and the bank that you bank with has a reserve account with the RBA. All happens there is that I tell the RBA to shift $1 billion out of my reserve account into the other bank's reserve account. And that happens there. The RBA just does that automatically. Right? Oh, what happens if my account goes negative? The RBA will lend me money overnight. At a little bit of a penalty rate, but that's okay. Apart from leakage into newly created cash, the $1 billion is always in the banking system. Right? This is the leakage, these little coins here. They're a very, very, very small part of the money system. Most of the money system is electrons in the banking system. That's created like this. The $1 billion that we created, credit, when Mike and I swapped these two worthless pieces of paper, that $1 billion is still in the banking system. Right? We've done a stock flow consistent analysis here. I haven't made any assumptions. Right? As a whole, the banking system doesn't need to borrow money to finance its lending. Let's put that up big. Lending creates its own deposits. Mike, you wanted to borrow $2 billion because you wanted to build two steel mills. I gave you $2 billion. Where'd the $1 billion extra come from? Doesn't matter. You want to borrow $1 billion. I'll give you $1 billion. You want to borrow? You want to borrow? I can get out there and I can lend money, 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 money. And the money will still stay in the banking system. In fact, very careful here, I shouldn't call that money. I should call it credit. I'm creating credit. Now, what breaks exist to stop this happening? Regulators, capital requirements, risk management, markets, shareholders, the board, auditors. Yes, we know how good they are. Rating agencies, yes. They're all supposed to put a brake on this. 8% risk-weighted assets or something like that. Risk managers. Well, we all know how many risk managers got sacked in the prior to the GFC for coming up to the boards and saying, hang on, we've got too much of a risk here. That doesn't work. When it gets right down to basics, none of those work. The GFC proved that none of that works. Take a look at UBS. Right? They lost $50 billion at least in these dodgy loans. What was the regulator doing? You know, I mean, we're talking about UBS. Their headquarters are, you know, sort of 100 kilometres from Basel. No, the regulator signed off all the time. Yeah, you're fine. What about the risk management group inside UBS? They weren't told. What about the shareholders? What about the board? A person on the board has been quoted as saying, we didn't even know what a CDO was until these things blew up. Right? The auditor. I won't say who the auditor was, but it's two letters, beginning with E, ending with Y. they signed off that this is a great risk management system that this company has. Right? The banking system is fundamentally out of equilibrium. Right? There is nothing that is going to stop an excessive amount of animal spirits from creating credit. Right? Because we can do it as easily as Mike and I swapping those little bits of paper. Right? Now, I'd love to think that risk managers are in there. We know that when push comes to shove, the risk managers get shoved. Right? This, I think, is extremely important to think about when we're trying to, what's the theme of this conference? Renovate the financial system. right, we have to recognise that the banking system is fundamentally capable of massive disequilibrium. Right? Do not think, hey, we're clever, we've got this covered, we've got Basel II, we've got auditors, you know, we've cleaned out the bad auditors after Enron, all the current ones are great. You know, we can calculate VAR to five decimal places, blah, blah, blah. Sorry, the banking system is fundamentally unstable. When we're all happy, we keep dancing, we keep making loans. When the music stops, we're depressed. We do nothing. If you want to characterise booms and busts in the economy, this is it. It's animal spirits. And we have to recognise that in the banking system. I have made no assumptions there in showing how unstable the banking system is, except basically to say that if anybody thinks that you can stop this, get real. We've got evidence-based theory from the last 2 years saying all of those rules and regulations that you think are going to work will not work when push comes to shove. So therefore, you know, you want to grab the second last chair. Leave Chuck Prince dancing, right? You want to grab the second last chair before the music stops, right? That's what you... And when the systems are bad, when everybody's upset and nobody's lending money and the whole economy just goes down, well, we got to get people up dancing again. Okay. A little bit of jargon now, a little bit of ideas as well. If you go into the theory of what I've just called, just discussed there's some really fantastic jargon in this area. That sort of approach there, if you push it and generalise it and all the rest of it, you get what is called the circuitist theory of banking. Money just goes round and round in circles, and you can just keep creating money. Fantastic. In a more general theory, these are called horizontal transactions. They're between banks. Notice that at that point, when Mike and I did our swap here of little pieces of worthless paper, there was no creation of net credit. I had a $1 billion liability. I had a $1 billion asset. Mike has the same. Nobody has created net credit at that real point of time. So, through the banking system, no net saving of financial assets is possible. Every time we create an asset, we create a corresponding liability. I can save, but society itself can't save financial assets through the banking system. Real assets can increase. And that's, you know, the other 99% of economics. Real assets can increase. I'm not saying that they can't, but financial assets, net financial assets, can't increase. You think, well, I bought a share of BHP when it was 10 bucks a few years ago, now it's 40 bucks. Surely that's an increase. Yeah, but you've got a $40 asset. Well, BHP has a $40 liability. So there's no net assets. Big increase in real assets, yes. I'm not saying there's no increase in real assets. Thank goodness we have been increasing real assets over the last few, you know, 200 years in Australia. So there's a little bit of jargon. Horizontal transactions, no increase in net credit. What are vertical transactions? I'm from the government and I'm here to help you. That's where we get vertical transactions. Banks up here, governments down here. A little bit of jargon. Banks have got reserve accounts with the RBA or any central bank that we like to call, right? They're usually reserve banks. Even the Federal Reserve is a reserve bank. Government payments and receipts operate through these reserve accounts. This is what we call vertical transactions in the jargon, right? Now I've moved off circuitists into an area called charterlists, which is not charter, as in I give you a charter for this. It's chartel, the Latin word for a token. Charterlists. Money is a token. So I'm operating through RAs. If the government wants to give you, you know, your pension payment, it says here's $100 and it puts it into the reserve account for whatever bank, the ANZ, and the ANZ bank has now got an asset of $100
but it creates a liability because the government told it to, which is a liability of an extra $100 in your bank account that you can then draw down. So government payments and receipts operate through RAs. The reserve accounts and the physical cash are high-powered money. Love that term, high-powered money. That's physical cash is what I've got in my pocket. The reserve accounts are the other form of high-powered money. Also, what I'm going to be talking about from now on is sovereign states that issue their own money and have a floating currency. So if you're worried about Greece, Portugal, Ireland and the rest, they are not sovereign states. They have the euro, and that is an extremely different kettle of fish than what happens in the UK, the US, Australia, Japan, and so forth. We are sovereign states. Germany and France are not sovereign states, and especially Greece and so forth. So I'm talking about sovereign states. The Eurozone is a completely separate animal. So let's talk about fiat money. I'm getting really excited. Can you keep me on track with time and so forth? Okay, what about fiat money? There's net government transactions. We buy goods and services as a government, and I collect taxes and fees. There's also neutral government transactions, borrowing. When the government borrows, it exchanges one government obligation for another. It takes money out of an RA, out of a reserve account, and gives you a piece of paper that says here's a government bond. Or actually it shifts electrons out of this account and gives you electrons in that account. That's neutral. One government obligation for another one. How do governments buy goods and services? They create high-powered money by increasing the reserve accounts by the price of the goods or whatever it is that they've bought. This is also actually giving you stuff if it wants to make a payment of a pension or something. So that's pure creation of high-powered money. If I give you a pension of $100, then we just get, you know, Ken Henry or whoever it is to type in $100 and into a keyboard, somebody's reserve account goes up and it then transferred into your account. That's all. It is just keystrokes. That's how the government spends money, under a fiat money system. We've been under fiat money for close on 40 years now. This is how governments spend under fiat money. They just put numbers into reserve accounts. They increase them if the government is buying goods and services. And what about when the government is collecting taxes and fees? It reduces the reserve accounts. There is destruction of high-powered money when the government taxes you or it collects a fee. It creates money when it buys, it destroys money when it collects taxes. Where does the high-powered money go? Nowhere. Where did it come from? Nowhere. Deadly serious. If you don't believe this happens, go and speak to Ken Henry or go and speak to the Reserve Bank. Go and ask them. Where does the money come from? They may give you a convoluted story about, you know, there is this government account. But, you know, you go down to Canberra, you look under the Treasury Department. Is there a Treasury Department dungeon where all this money is? No. Go to Martin Place. Is it there? No. There's no dungeon under Martin Place where they keep all the money. It is actually destroyed. High-powered money, it's just a little entry in a ledger. Right? You may have a government account for accounting purposes because, accountants have been with us for a couple of thousand years. They like to make sure the books balance. So there is a government account there which adds up and keeps everything neutral. But there is no limit to that government account. It can be massively positive. It can be massively negative. There is no physical limit to it. I'm going to be talking about what can physically happen, not what institutions stop is happening. This is what physically happens. That government account is purely for show. Okay? I'll be very careful. So what I've talked about so far, there are no assumptions. You can go and talk to the RBA, you can go and talk to Treasury, and if you cut through all the jargon of the institutions, what you get is this. There is no limit to what that government account can do. Except that limits that we impose for ourselves via various institutional processes.
Now, what about net financial assets? When the government spend money, they create net financial assets in the private sector. In the whole private government sector combined, the whole economy, there are still no net financial assets. But when the government spends, they create net financial assets in the private sector. The government spends $100,
you now have $100 in your account that is not associated with another liability in the private sector. It's yours. You've now got a net financial asset. You couldn't get that without creating another liability except via the government sector. Now, what happens when the government collects money?
They are actually destroying net financial assets in the private sector. If I give you $100,
you've got now $100 of net financial assets. Then I come over here and look, Mike's made a profit with $1 billion Goodwill. I'm going to ask him with $100 tax. Standard. That's why we have to get an RSQT. Nowhere near the proper amount of tax here. So, $100 of tax.
I guess destroyed $100 of net financial assets because he had to just give me that money. And if he had $100 of assets and $100 of liabilities, I've now grabbed his $100 of assets. He still has the $100 of liabilities. Luckily, there's $100 of assets over here that actually match that. If these two things match, then they get there. So, government deficits create net financial assets. If the government spends more than it collects in taxes, it creates net financial assets in the private sector. If the government runs a surplus, it is destroying net financial assets in the private sector. Has anybody ever said that to you before? Did Swan the other night jump up there and say, we're going to run a surplus in 3 years' time because we want to destroy net financial assets in the private sector? Where has my logic gone wrong? This is pure stock flow, consistent analysis of where high-powered money is flowing and where credit goes. Okay. When I first came across this sort of analysis as I was trying to understand modern money, I thought, oh, this is crap. I got to this point and I thought, I've reached something that I can really understand now because the logic was presented reasonably clearly and I thought, right, I can follow this, but I sure as hell do not like that conclusion. That is against everything that I have ever learned. Oh, as well as the first part about banks creating credit. When I did my one and only economics course, I was told that banks actually recycle credit, that banks go and gather up all this small amount of money from people like you, and then they lend it out. Actually, it's completely the reverse. They lend it out, and the money then flows back in the back door to provide the small deposits. This is completely the reverse of what is still taught in economics courses. Banks lend, and the deposits basically look after themselves. You don't, as a bank, in a modern system, you don't have to go and get the deposits. It helps when you do. There's asset liability questions further down the track if you don't make sure you balance those. But to lend money, you don't need the deposits first, you just lend. And this one too. This is completely back to front from what I learned. Government surpluses destroy net financial assets in the private sector. If you take a look at any country where it has run financial surpluses, you will find that those financial surpluses end in a crash in the economy. Yes?
Frank, I'm just wondering, isn't what's happening the transfer of the net financial assets from the public sector to the private sector when you're running a deficit and vice versa when you're running a surplus?
Yes. So through the cycle, if I run a net zero, there are no net new financial assets in the private sector. Correct. You could be running that.
Now what I mean is if you add up the public sector and the private sector...
Oh, yeah, they add up to zero. Yeah, I'm ignoring the rest of the world here, of course. If we run a trade deficit or whatever, we're going to get something else. But I'm ignoring the rest of the world. Or you can consider that I'm just assuming this is the whole world here. But
the government has a net deficit here.
But what the hell? There's three corollaries from this. Number one, taxes aren't revenue raised for government consumption. Government just, if a government wants to consume it, just makes the money up when it does it. And that strictly is what it does. There might be a government account that's there for accounting purposes, but there is nothing stopping the government spending whatever it likes. And that includes pensions. If the government pays pensions, it just credits the amount into your account. It doesn't have to raise taxes or borrow to do it. The second thing, if you follow the money stream, where do you get the money to pay taxes? The money you use to pay taxes has to come from government spending. If you find that the government is actually not spending and it is collecting taxes from you, you do the stock flow consistent analysis and figure out where that money's coming from. It's coming from the money that the government has spent, right? I don't, as a government, raise taxes so I can spend money. I spend money so that my taxpayers can pay tax. If I don't spend money, they have no net assets to use to pay. Whoever I raise taxes from have to actually borrow the money from the bank or somewhere, pay me as the government, and they're left with a liability and no asset. It is only me as the government, by spending money, that gives net financial assets to the taxpayers so that they can pay their tax. This is completely the reverse of what everybody in this room, I bet, assumed would happen before. But take a look at the stock flow consistent analysis. Right? This is what happens. I have not made too many assumptions here. Pretty much none. A string of government surpluses will exhaust private savings, eventually leading to higher private debt levels. Yeah. Every time governments run a consistent surplus, you take a look at what happens to private debt levels. They go up and up and up. So, what's the whole point of this? Well, how should we discuss government budgets? Sovereign governments can always pay their bills by creation of high-powered money. And the technical word here, the big one, is sovereign, right? This is not Greece. Okay, default is never necessary in a sovereign government. Right? It doesn't matter. Now, intergenerational report, it doesn't matter how much I'm promising my pensioners. I'm able to pay them as a government because all I'm doing is creating cash, creating excess reserve accounts. That cost me nothing more than a couple of, a bit of RSI on the fingers. The governments don't have to finance their spending. But, and this is a big but, I'm not saying the governments can just spend. The effect on the economy is real. So the question that we need to ask is government spending consistent with economic activity? That's the question. Not how do we finance this, but is the government spending, net spending or spending and taxation, is that consistent with the real economy? If, the government spends and it uses up real goods and services. Now, if real goods and services are fully utilised in the economy already, then spending will increase prices and it will lead to inflation. On the other hand, if we have real goods and services, and one of the most important services that's around there is unemployed labour. If these are underutilised, then more government spending might not affect prices. So if we are going through a recession and governments spend money, it is not necessarily going to lead to an inflationary pressure because there are, by the very definition, we're in a recession, there are underutilised resources out there. You're unemployed. I come along and employ you as the government. And you're not going to bid up labour prices. Now, if you're fully employed and I have to go and compete with BHP to employ you, then I'm going to have to raise prices. But as the government,
if I'm spending in a recession, I'm not necessarily going to affect prices.
So, too low economic activity, increased spending, reduced taxes, increase the deficit, create net financial assets out there. Too high economic activity, reduced spending, increased taxes, increased fees. So a reduction in deficit, maybe even running a surplus. And if I'm running a surplus, there'd better be net financial assets out there that I'm going to be destroying. Because I am destroying them if I'm running a surplus. This is the way that we should be thinking about it. I've got a government, I've got taxes coming in, I've got spending going out. The standard way in which the debate is being run around the world at the moment is saying, do we have this sort of process down here? Do we have financing of our spending? And this down here doesn't happen. Government taxes, the money is just thrown away. It is not thrown away, it just disappears. It just is a reduction in the reserve accounts at the banks, at the central bank. And when money is spent, it is creation of money in those central things. There is no transfer of money over here. We don't have little gnomes going from the Reserve Bank down to Canberra with that. The real thing, the debate needs to be up here. What are the effects of the taxes and the spending on the real economy? That is the question. So, if anybody talks about financing, they're in gold standard thinking. This is the thinking that is relevant if we were under the Bretton Woods system or if we were under a gold standard. The question being, and if we were Greece, for example, where am I going to get enough euros or enough gold to actually spend? Because I actually need these things to spend. I have to make sure that I get them via my taxes. But if I'm under a fiat money system, there is no financing. Accept it as an accounting fiction. The real question we need to ask ourselves, and if we're under a gold standard, we don't have to ask ourselves what happens to the real economy. We can just say, well, I can't spend more than I tax. But with fiat money, this doesn't happen. This happens. We have to ask ourselves, what is going to happen on the real economy? That is where the question comes. In the intergenerational debate, if I do have to create money to pay these pensions and I'm not getting an equivalent amount coming down here in my taxes, what's the effect going to be on the real economy? Is it going to shift prices upwards? We don't have to finance the pensions. We have to ask ourselves, if I do pay people all these pensions and I only have 2.7 people over here per pensioner, what's going to happen? What's happening up there in the real economy? That's the question. I haven't seen that asked. That's the question. It's not where does the money come from. It's what is the effect up here on that money flowing through? Government borrowing, which I seem to have left out. Government surpluses increase reserve accounts. If the reserve banks around the world pay target interest rates on the RAs, then there's no problem. Because the banks can leave their surplus reserve accounts in at the central bank. If the Reserve Bank doesn't pay an interest rate on these, which effectively means it pays a zero rate, then if I am a bank and I have a surplus reserve amount, what am I going to do? If the central bank is not going to pay me interest, I'll try and get money on that. And I will lend it out at anything above zero. So this is amazing. But if central banks do not pay interest on excess reserves, and most of them do these days, then the natural interest rate target, and I will explicate this if anybody wants, the natural interest rate is zero if the government is spending a surplus. So what actually happens when governments borrow? What we trade as a government is we trade high-powered money
for longer-term maturity assets. There's actually no decrease in government liabilities. If the government wants to borrow, money flows out of a reserve account and it flows into another account, typically at the Treasury, that says somebody has $1 billion worth of bonds. Right? There is no decrease or no increase in net government liabilities. It's just a transfer of one government asset for another one. Equivalently, it's doing a fixed for floating interest rate swap with the Reserve Bank, one that's collateralised on a daily basis. You can think of it like a... except for credit risk, right? It's just done a fixed for floating swap. Easy. Corollary. Sovereign governments don't have to borrow at all. What does government borrowing do? It's a service to the banks to help them with risk-free maturity profile structuring. That's all. So the government isn't borrowing for its own benefit. The government is actually providing a service to the banking industry. That's great. Yeah, relax, take a deep breath. What's the point? All arguments on government deficits are just plain wrong, actually, according to this. And this is contentious. It is nowhere near mainstream, as you'd expect. All the arguments that you most probably hear are typically based on a gold standard type of thinking, because that is the way the institutions are set up. We've been off the gold standard for 40 years. Sorry for those people who think that we're still on a gold standard or Bretton Woods. We've been off it. We've been on fiat money for 40 years. We've got to make sure that we debate properly what's happening. Otherwise, we're going to reach suboptimal policies. You've already seen the debate about, how quickly can we turn around, the deficits and so forth. If we're still in a recession, that's liable to be dangerous. Individual and corporate actions can be driven by the wrong argument. For example, take Japan's position. Huge government deficit, low interest rates. Japan's position is completely in line with that theory that I was explaining. Right? When you've got high government deficits with underutilised resources, what do you get? Low interest rates, possible deflation, and no problem with borrowing. That's Japan's position at the moment. Conclusion. Is there anything dangerous to your firm because you really don't understand money and credit? What if we're actually going to head towards what Japan is doing and interest rates are going to go down to 1.5%, maybe even 1%, and short-term rates stay at zero for a significant number of years? What's the risk to government policy of the wrong understanding? And most importantly, how can we change the debate? Because I think the debate at the moment is extremely poisonous worldwide. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that, Frank. Now I'd like to throw it open to the audience at this point. I've got a microphone to pass around. Please state your name into the microphone. And I'm encouraging a wide variety of comments. And yes, Mike can be first.
Nice question.
Can I have my tax back? I'll start off.
Yes, I'll
I don't disagree with any of your logic or your conclusions. However, that's the
bit. However, yes, there's always an however.
Deficits do matter. The reason I think they matter is because if you keep running up a deficit, then convention is that the government pays interest on
convention,
its borrowings.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
The reason Japan has built up government borrowings of more than 200% of GDP is because the interest rate is so low, it doesn't really matter very much. If Japan had to pay 5% interest or 10% interest on its 200% of GDP, it would be catastrophic.
Why?
What would happen is the deficit would compound at an alarming rate because the government borrowing increases at the rate of the interest rate adjusted for nominal GDP.
Yes. You think the government has to borrow, so you're back in gold standard era.
No, I'm saying if the government doesn't borrow, then
The money flows straight into the reserve accounts at the central banks, and it stays there because the government doesn't want to borrow. The government just increases the reserve accounts.
I'm assuming that the money is going. If the government's not borrowing, then at some point the economy will get overheated.
Bank of Japan would love that, right? Yes, at some point the economy will become overheated. Oh, the government, the Bank of Japan, everybody in Japan would love that. It is not happening. It hasn't happened for the last 15 years. When are we going to start saying that maybe it won't happen? Maybe our theories are wrong. It hasn't happened yet. Worry about that when it looks like it's happening. It hasn't happened for the last 15 years. Sorry, I'm getting a little bit expressive, but I'm trying to emote here.
Yeah, point taken.
They should have
been borrowing as much in the past. The economy might have started about a
grand. But it doesn't matter. They actually spent badly. They could have done better spending with the money that they've done. But you know, there's the government can just keep increasing the reserve accounts. And when the economy starts to look like it's overheated, then it can stop spending. In fact, at that point, the automatic stabilizers will come back and Japan will move closer to a balanced budget. Does it have to repay the debt? Why?
I'd like to think so. Unfortunately, I think a lot of countries don't have appropriate automatic stabilizers. And a number of countries, particularly the United States, has embarked upon a set of spending programs that are not going to stabilise, virtually all the projections of the American economy show that that deficit is going to go on increasing forever.
But why are you worried about a deficit?
I think the
logic of where all the money goes.
Yeah, it's the fact that the government is paying interest on its accumulated deficit, in effect,
because it's not
allowing it to stay.
The interest on an accumulated deficit goes straight to the reserve accounts.
What it's starting to do is dominate the government's accounting treatment. So that I've seen forecasts that say if the government pays interest on its accumulated deficits, then in a number of years' time, 3/4 of the taxes that are being raised under the current tax programs will be spent on adding interest to past accumulated deficits.
See, you're talking here. The taxes don't pay here. Who's the current treasurer? Geithner? Whenever Geithner gets a dollar in tax, he just throws it away. He doesn't use it to spend. That is precisely the gold standard thinking that you've been expounding there. The government doesn't have to raise taxes to spend the money. It can just spend the money.
And
the question is, what is happening up here in the real economy? You haven't mentioned the real economy there.
Can I just have an indication who else would like to join the debate? Okay. Yeah. At this point, we might just pass it around.
I told you there was no problem with having pre-programmed questions.
I might just give it to Richard first. Oh, okay. Yeah. Just Richard first, then you, Michelle.
Yeah.
And then who else would be like to...
Yeah.
Okay, look, John.
This took me months to convince myself that this is so back to front.
Okay,
but I couldn't fault the logic.
Richard Lyon, I can't fault the logic either, but my big concern is that we've assumed away the outside world. And I know you say that for the world as a whole that it still works, and I would agree, but we don't have a sovereign world. We have a sovereign country.
Can I just say that to do that would make this three times as long, but it actually doesn't change the conclusions.
I think that's what we here haven't spent as long as you going through this. I think that's what we're struggling with.
That's right.
Because to us, the US dollar or international currency or something is our gold standard.
No, it's not.
To us, I think it is.
What, you
I
mean
think
when... You,
to the audience here.
Yeah, and that's the problem. That's where a lot of our thinking is. And it's been 40 years since we've moved off the gold standard. Yeah, like you, when I first came across this, this is complete rubbish. And that's why I seized on it, because it was not written in academic jargon. And if you've downloaded my paper on the website, you'll see that I wrote that at a kindergarten level. Because if you read this other modern money, the other theories about money, you can't put those at a kindergarten level. This can be described at a kindergarten level because it is just stock flow consistent. And when we introduce the rest of the world, it is stock flow consistent there as well. So it actually, the rest of the world complicates it but doesn't change these conclusions. Yes, we have to be careful about what's happening in the rest of the world. One of the reasons this works is currencies go up and down. That's why we're sovereign. But yeah, it complicates it but doesn't really change it. You know, I knew an hour wasn't going to be good enough for this.
Yes, we've got 5 minutes, Michelle.
Okay. Michelle Vandenberg, I just want to know how you explain this theory in the context of what's happening in Zimbabwe.
Oh, Zimbabwe had a massive destruction of the real economy. And the same thing happened in Weimar Germany. So Zimbabwe, when you have a massive destruction of real assets and the government meets that by running the printing presses, then you get hyperinflation. But a massive destruction of real assets is not what we're talking about with the GFC.
Yep. John?
The same thing happened with Weimar Germany, the other major hyperinflation that people talk about.
John Oakley. Frank, as Richard said, we haven't spent as much time thinking about this as you have, apologies. Apologies if these are stupid questions, but a couple of things that are bothering me. When a government runs a deficit, so more's going out than's coming in, and its debts increase, who does the government owe that money to? And when it pays interest on those negative account balances, who's it paying that money to?
The government doesn't have to borrow to spend. The government just spends the money. That means there's an increase in the reserve accounts. And the banks, if the Reserve Bank is not actually paying interest on those reserve accounts, then banks will want to remove money from those reserve accounts, take down their excess reserves, and go and look for anybody who wants to borrow money. And so the natural tendency for a government that is running a big deficit is for interest rates to go to zero. You didn't hear that, did you? Nobody taught you that. Interest rates go to zero if the government runs a large deficit.
But we're running a deficit at the moment, and the government...
Reserve Bank has kept interest rates up at 4.5% because it pays interest on the excess reserves.
Who's it paying that money to? I'm not quite understanding that.
The bank that has the excess reserves.
Right, and then where does that money go once that's...
That's why you buy bank shares.
I think we've got time for one last question. Yeah, at the back there.
What about the Great Depression? Is that because that was the gold standard? Because basically that financing there still caused a significant impact in the real economy.
It caused a significant impact in the real economy in the Great... I mean, people are still arguing about why the Great Depression happened. But there was a fundamental mismatch there. Lots of countries came off the gold standard, and one of the arguments that people have, assuming economists are people, is did the earlier you come off the gold standard and adopt this sort of approach, though nobody did explicitly, but Keynesian thinking is behind this. If you know, this is not too far away from Keynes's treatise on money. One of the arguments is that countries that came off the gold standard fastest had less of a Great Depression.
I think we're going to have to leave it on that point. But I'd like to thank you, Frank, for this very energetic and challenging presentation. And on behalf of you all, I've got a bottle of wine to present to you.